In this episode on Trauma-Informed Biographical Timelines, Jo talks about the evolution of timelines, beginning with her first experiences facilitating timelines for people who were leaving state-run institutions. She also reflects on the evolution that teams go through during the process, as often people will realize that what they were doing to support someone might not have been the best at the time, but it was what they knew, and now they know better.
You know, I was introduced to a biographical timeline about 30 years ago. And this was, of course, long before the trauma-informed part of the work came to be what it is today. But, you know, back many years ago, I was living and working in Rhode Island, and we were closing the one state institution, which meant that we were trying to find homes and help create lives for people who had been living in an institution, you know, often their whole life. So we were working with a group of people who were, you know, working in agencies that were welcoming these people back to their home communities, but didn't know who these people were and really didn't know how to get, you know, how to wrap their heads around thinking about supporting them. It was kind of outside of their experience. So,
And these are people who lived their whole lives in institutions who have never been in the community spaces, and the community has not also been around many inclusive settings or been around people with disabilities themselves.
Yeah, often the case. And for a lot of these people, too, it was people who had been placed in these institutions because they were too fill in the blank, right? Too out of control, had too many, quote, behavior challenges or too whatever to have their families accommodate their in their homes. So these were people who had reputations, right? And then, of course, we know what happened in the institutions. Their lives right. were really bereft of any kind of quality interactions with, as you say, with anyone else. And often people were experienced, you know, abuse and neglect and saw horrible things. Mm-hmm. So by the time our system got around to having these people move out, they had really suffered terribly. So our challenge was to figure out a way to understand who these people were and try to align supports to help them. And as I said, we didn't have any understanding of trauma at that time. The research, the work was just nowhere. But we did know that it was important to take time to try to understand what the person's life had been from the shoes of that person, from the perspective of that person.
So getting a glimpse into what are they feeling right now based on what they've lived.
Well, asking ourselves, what did we know? What is the first things we knew about that person's life? Why did their family take them to this place? How old were they when they got there? And really stopping and imagining out loud with each other, what would it have been like to be 6 years old and your family saying, let's go for a Sunday drive, and you're dropped off and your family is told, don't come back for a year. They'll get adjusted better if you don't, you know? So really sitting, right? Sitting with that information and asking ourselves, what would that have been like? What would that have felt like? What would that have done to you if you were a 6 year old? And then following that timeline and imagining, you know, based on what we know about what this place looked like and how it was staffed and how it was organized, what would have a typical day have been like for that six-year-old? What would have been, what would a year look like? What would have been the rhythm of a year in a state institution if you were a child? And we had enough information, you know, historical information and information among the people in the planning group, that we knew the answers to that stuff. We knew, for instance, that Christmas was always celebrated a week early. You never had Christmas on Christmas if you lived in an institution because staff were off on Christmas. And, you know, so you had Christmas early. And, you had the 4th of July parade on July 2nd. And so, you know, there was just a lot that we knew, you know, from our files and from historical data.
Like a strange existence, sort of, is what you're talking about. It's like this is a little bit of an odd existence to then come back to what is the real world, quote unquote, and see what life was really like outside of the institution. And
yes, yes. And, you know, imagine that that 6-year-old is now a 46-year-old and has begun to develop some ways of surviving in that institution, and it might include eating all your food in 30 seconds or trying to put all your possessions in your pockets or in your backpack and carry them around with you all day. And the group that was remembering this or knowing that this was how this 46-year-old was now adapting to his institutional environment, we could say, well, where did that come from? And it's pretty clear, you know, that those were not bizarre behaviors, those were survival behaviors, right? So we were able then to kind of say, if that's what that person has done to survive, how can we honor that as we help that person move from the state institution to back to his hometown? And we could use that journey back into that person's timeline to have the staff really have some empathy and understanding of that person's life from the perspective of that person.
So the new staff that's supporting them, not the institutional staff.
Exactly.
The new staff to understand, who maybe have never stepped foot in an institution before, to go through some of, okay, this is what it really was like to, like you said, be in this person's shoes.
Yeah.
And then eating something in 30 seconds, can you explain kind of how that would show up on a timeline? Like, what would that look like?
Well, most likely on a timeline, you'd see something like, you know, restrictive measures put in place to tie his arms down so that he couldn't feed himself, and staff fed him while his arms were tied to a chair. And, you know, you go back and you look at the case files on that, and you would see it was to prevent him from eating too quickly because he was choking.
It's hard to even fathom that that's a real story, that is actually something that you witnessed and heard and walked alongside somebody through who had experienced that.
I remember the day I walked into that institution, and I was meeting with some people to plan for a person's move, and a woman who lived there at the institution, not to do with anything that I was there for, came up to me and introduced herself. I didn't know at the time that's what she was doing, because what she said was, I'm a ground, and I didn't know what that meant. And she started pantomiming eating and kept saying, feeding herself, and kept saying, I'm a ground. And then one of the staff who worked at the institution came up and said, she's telling you that she has her food ground at meals, and the people who have their food ground sit at a separate table, and it says ground. And so she knows that, quote, she's a ground. So to me, that was just a really powerful story about how people's life experiences can so impact their identity, right? And she had told me this kind of with some enthusiasm, right, and some sense of importance, and, you know, reflecting on how absolutely bereft of experience and opportunity her life must have been, for her to, the thing for her to be proud about was being, quote, a ground, that somehow gave her status.
That's what she belonged to. That's the table she belonged to.
Yeah.
How does the history that you were part of translate to today's world?
Yeah, if we had held a timeline conversation focusing on this woman's life, and had asked the question, who is she? One of the very reasonable responses that we could have, that could have come out of that conversation would be, sees herself as, quote, a ground, right? That's who she saw herself to be. So then we would ask the questions, if you think that's who you are, then what do you need? And someone would have said, someone who thinks their identity is a ground needs an opportunity for new forms of identity, to be known as something else. And then we'd ask ourselves, what would it take to be known as something else? And we would have started imagining other experiences and opportunities that lined up with whatever else we knew about her interests or her gifts.
What are the different types of labels that are parallel to being aground?
Oh, I think there are numerous, like hoarder, right? He's a hoarder. Is something that you might hear about, and it, have it said in disparaging and accusational kind of tone. And if we had an opportunity to think about that person's life experiences in the context of a timeline conversation, we would be looking for and listening for what were his or her life experiences that hoarding things came to be a reasonable way to survive or to accommodate to the environment that you were in. Mm-hmm. Like, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. And there's always a story about that. Mm-hmm. And when we know the story, we can start to shift from blaming the person for being a hoarder to honoring how that particular set of behaviors was probably a creative and resourceful response to some horrible situation that he or she was in. And we can say, good for you. You figured out a way to survive that. And you've held tightly onto that because you felt like you needed to. And our job is to be as respectful about that particular way of facing the world, that hoarding, quote, behavior. Not try to take it away, not try to diminish it, but to honor the place it's had in that person's life and ask ourselves, what does that person need and what's that going to take so that that person no longer feels down the road someplace that he or she has to, quote, hoard in order to be safe.
And it's a reshaping of an identity. Is that true as well, that the idea isn't to become firm or proud in your identity as a hoarder or a ground, but to actually be seen in a whole new way, to reshape how people refer to you?
Yeah. You know, people who have had really difficult lives have had to put all their energies and all their thinking and all their time and all their mental and emotional resources into getting through a day, right? Or surviving a horrible environment. And when we take our work seriously to create the structures and environment where people don't have to be on high alert and do whatever they no longer have to use whatever accommodations that they've been forced to use in the past, then it opens up space, you know, for people to step into something new and different.
Mm-hmm. How do you bring the whole team together around that new identity and around that new path for that person? And you facilitated many of these timelines yourself. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm asking specifically to the facilitator, what is your role in bringing the team together to see beyond the negative aspect maybe of somebody that's being brought to light? Because trauma in many ways is often a secret. It can be thought of as something that you don't want to talk about, you don't want out there in the open, it's a private matter. So by bringing it on to paper and to life through this timeline, you as a facilitator have to be very delicate, it seems like, about how to use the information. And so how do you do that?
You know, there are some timeline conversations where the person is not in the room. They know about the conversation, they know what's being discussed, and for reasons that we can all understand, some people just say, that's just not a conversation I can be a part of. I want you to have it. I want people to understand what I've been through. I don't want to be in the room. It's too much. So when people say that, we honor that. That means that the people in the room are some combination of other supporters, people who have worked with the person in the past, people who might be working with the person now. And they would have a range of different experiences and perspectives coming into the room, right? And as a facilitator, your work is to help people lay out on the timeline events and experiences that we know happened, and often people report that the person went through a really horrible experience and developed some sort of strategy, some sort of accommodation to get through that, that now is being labeled as, a quote, bad behavior. So if people describe that experience, the facilitator can simply ask, how does that experience show up today? And someone will say, he hoards today. And I can see that that's connected with this experience because of such and such, mm-hmm. right? And they'll make the connection themselves. Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of just asking the right questions, paying attention to also the responses in the room of how people maybe emotionally are shifting or changing and being attuned to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see people deepen their own understanding of their person's experience while they're sitting around the table. And a lot of times that's really painful because as a staff person, I might have just realized that something that I was doing was not helpful and probably even harmful for that person. And I might have done that with all the best of intentions. And so if I'm understanding that in this timeline conversation, it's a hard thing for me as a staff person to understand that. And people have a lot of different ways they express their pain about that, right? Some people will say, I now realize and I'm really sorry. Mm-hmm. Others might cry or others might get angry because that is sometimes our response to our own pain. I was in a timeline conversation not too long ago, where in the conversation people shared many parts of the story that weren't known to all about this young woman's abandonment early in life by her parents, and how she was cared for her by her grandmother, and that her grandmother kept her safe through what then were years of really horrible life situation. Later on in the timeline, this agency became connected with this woman, and this woman was doing a lot of things that were difficult for the staff to understand because of her past trauma experiences. As a result of some of these behaviors, quote, behaviors, she was hospitalized, and the staff made the decision not to inform her grandmother because they, in their opinion at the time, they thought that she was, quote, manipulating her grandmother through trying to get admitted into this hospital. And through the course of the conversation, I remember this one staff person who was responsible for that decision just started weeping, you know, and just saying, I can't believe we did that. You know, we kept her away from the one person in her life who's been a safe thread for her. So that, you know, that is not that uncommon an experience in a timeline conversation, because that staff person and many staff who work in many organizations have this legacy of bad advice, right? That and myth that's out there about how you respond and what to do, and she was doing the best she knew how to do at that time.
Yeah, and the empathy that she has was there all along, but it sounds like it really came out when she realized what the best way to do things was, yeah. And knowing she was maybe part of some of the trauma,
yeah,
built even more empathy for that person.
Exactly. And it's, so as a facilitator, what you're aware of is that the empathy that the group can show to this woman who's now weeping in the timeline can be a mirror for the empathy that the staff person shows for the focus person in her own life.
Okay.
So the timeline conversation can be an opportunity to embody.
As a facilitator, showing your empathy towards that staff person and being able to allow the room that space as well to empathize and...
Yes, and I would say even more importantly than the facilitator demonstrating, the facilitator's responsibility is to create space for the group to be able to do that together, mm-hmm. right? Because people are going to leave having experienced each other differently. And that's what will carry over, right? The facilitator may or may not be around, but the group can have an experience of saying, we did the best we knew how to do then. It wasn't a good thing. Now we know better. We're going to try to do better as we go forward, and we're still going to make mistakes, and we're still going to honor each other's best attempts.
So when you started this in Rhode Island and to today, it's been an evolving process. Is that right?
The process of the timelines has evolved as we've learned more about trauma and understood more about how trauma lives in the body and how it shows up in development. So that certainly informed our work a lot. I will say, though, that the core of it has stayed the same. The core questions around who is this person and what do they need and what will it take, that has really kind of stayed constant over the years.
And what is the best outcome from it, from a timeline? What is the best outcome that could come from one?
I am thrilled when a group of people has a deep respect for the person and the life that they have lived so far. And when people understand not just what happened, but how what happened shaped that person's life and experiences, and become committed together to continue to walk with that person so that their experiences can be different going forward.